IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 90 of the Killing It Podcast. I had to say 90 with an exclamation mark.
90.
That's a big thing.
We're getting close. We're getting closer all the time. So
exactly. It deserves an exclamation point. And because as we predicted at the very beginning of this stuff, we were never going to run out of cool topics to talk about there. And there's literally more things to talk about this week than there was in week one. So
it's funny. Sometimes we email back and forth like 42 things and we're like, okay, pick three.
Yeah, you only get three. I'll tell you exactly. What, since we got a little time and we haven't decided anything, if you've got a listeners, if you've got something you would like us to tackle for the 100, we're open to ideas. This is a good time. We've got something up our sleeves for year end, but 100 is about 10 weeks away. So we got some time here.
Also, tell your friends about it. We've really appreciated the folks who have shared this on social media and giving it a thumbs up on iTunes and everywhere else. So, you know, wherever you listen to it, please give us a positive review and tell your friends.
We certainly appreciate it. And we appreciate being sponsored. This week, we are sponsored by Gazinta Mobius, the easiest way for ConnectWise Manage and QuickBooks Online to connect. Keep invoices, expenses, and inventory automatically updated right from Manage to QuickBooks Online and payments right back into Manage. With simple pricing, set it and forget it auto-sync, Gazinta Mobius delivers with no restrictions on the number of invoices, expenses, and payments, and it plays well with others like Connect Booster. Trusted by over 1,000 MSPs, now introducing a free plan. Go to gazinta.com/Mobius and tell them the guys from Killing It sent you.
Killing It.
Well, I'm going to kick us off then this week with one of those funny things is as we are approaching the end of the year and we're all starting to think about the differences of the way we'll take time off, there's been a couple of articles about burnout in the pandemic world and what to do about it. We're going to link to two articles here. The first talking from a high level about the general element of postponed vacations, holiday and isolations, back-to-back meetings, and the number of underused vacation days, particularly in the U.S. You know, in 2019, U.S. workers earned 23.7 days of paid time off, but only used 17.2. And by the way, this year, it's going to be even worse. But then we've also got an article from DICE, which dives into the question, are you feeling a lack of motivation? And this is, they talked to lots of the major companies in technology, names you've all heard of, and find that overall, some 80% of technologists said they're demotivated at work. And by the way, at the FANG firms, it's 83%. So guys, we're burning out people.
Well, I have to say, this is not the least bit of a surprise. So one of my favorite books that I've written is called Relax, Focus, Succeed, where I tell people the lowest common denominator is work more hours and think you're going to get more done. And we've always had a problem in this industry of people working from home and never quite unplugging. And that's, I mean, what else can you expect when you're shut in at home for 9 months, except the lines between work and home get very, very fuzzy. And a lot of people are not willing to stand up and say, it's after six, I'm not going to be on the computer anymore.
See, and I'll go there from a manager or a leader's perspective. It is one thing to keep your company going. It's another thing to focus on how do we survive and thrive through the downturn and all of the disruption. It is another thing to bring your humans with you. Now, I remember back in the May timeframe, we did a conversation on an earlier episode of this podcast where we talked about how managers need to update the way that they interact with people, like not keyboard trackers and right. social media settings where we can micromanage our people. We need to give them the confidence and the trust that they're doing their job. And we need to shift out of managing by the number of hours you work and into managing by the results that you produce. And what we are hearing now is all y'all didn't do that. And it's giving us the bad impact that we thought that it was going to get. Nobody is surprised. The world is scary. The economy is hinky in a lot of places. You can't go to a restaurant as much as you want to. These are natural things that are going to make people stressed out. And then you add on top of that micromanagement and back-to-back-to-back-to-back meetings and just grinding on people. I can't see you. I don't know if you're actually trying. And what am I getting for what I'm paying you? We're making it worse. And all of these technology tools, they're supposed to make our lives better, better living through technology. We're actually using them to reduce people's peace of mind and life satisfaction.
Frequently unintentional.
Voluntary. Yeah, exactly.
It's not many that times. Managers are evil. It's just like, hey, I expect you to be available. And it used to be if you were available these 8 hours, but you spent, you know, one of them walking back and forth, up and down the hallway, taking a bathroom break and whatever, you actually had moments of relaxation.
Yep.
When you're scheduled 60-minute webinars or Zoom calls back to back, there is no potty break.
Well, it's funny because this is for me one of those areas where maybe I'm a little contrarian on some of this stuff, because I have stopped worrying about time as a measurement a very long time ago in terms of the way that I look at my own productivity and teams that I manage productivity. It's for me, it's much more about the commitments and schedule, commitments and deliverables that people then manage on the schedule that they sign up for as much as possible. Obviously you impose some levels of, sometimes we have a deadline that if we're working on an event or we have something that is not movable, but you work to the plan and let people control when things get done. My other statement on this has always been the SLA of communication. I set expectations, for example, that, I don't deliver responses in real time on anything. That's not an SLA I signed up for, right, unless you pay a certain level of rate for that. It's everything is for sale, but my email is for me. It is not for you. You putting something into it does not change my response to that. But it requires discipline, and it requires a level of you have to break the norms a little bit to achieve that. And obviously, it's never perfect, right? There are certain customers that pay me at a certain rate. That means they do get a certain level of response, but I have signed up to that versus yep. allowing anybody to take that attention anytime they want.
We also have to recognize, so this research that we're talking about today is particularly with the bigger tech firms.
Yes.
But there has been other research during the year about people saying, hey, I kind of like working from home because I can do a split shift. I can take 2 hours, deal with the family, then get back to my computer and be productive when the rest of the world has turned off the webinar series, right? And so, people who use it well, I think are finding that they can manage this. And
see, but that
you said something that, key there. You said something really key, and I want to is people that manage that well. That's the key phrase for there is there are a lot of people that don't understand that that work from home or that take control of it puts the impetus on you, the individual employee, to manage and push back on that.
Right.
I personally have always maintained, and I say this to people that work for me, part of your compensation is your days off. If you're not taking that, would you say no to a paycheck? Because if you're saying no to vacation days, you are just literally refusing money. And I'm not in the business of refusing money. They could pay me more and give me less vacation. That is one option of that. But they have given me that vacation because, by the way, it is also good for my productivity that I take it. And that does not mean go on vacation and be on call for my employer. That means I'm going on vacation and I'm not there anymore.
See, but that's the thing, right? That's exactly where the good news in this story is. If you manage it conscientiously, proactively, like actually set your principles and your schedule and stick to those things. And if you use technology to make you more productive and to give you the connectivity that you need to work from anywhere, this can actually be a catalyst for a much better working experience for the individual and productivity-wise for the employer. You got to do it on purpose, and you have to actually make investments. One of the things in this article that we're linked to that I think is very important is coming back to the idea of what can you do on purpose to make this hurt less? Scheduling downtime between calls, doing things deliberately for fun and not for productivity, right? After hours, cocktail hours, things like that. Do something on purpose to care for your humans. And A, they will produce more because the research on taking your vacation days and actually producing better when you come back, that's incontrovertible. We are better machines when we are relaxed and not freaked out all the time. You can get better results from your people. You can let this technology work from them. For all the talk that we've had in the last 9 months about work from anywhere and all this connectivity and collaboration, the tool does not solve the problem. It is about how you use the tool to create a better environment for your people, right, and better results for the business.
To extend that, I mean, if you're interested in seeing some of the more cutting edge stuff on this too, because you're exactly right, Ryan, that research is all just proven. If you want to see some of the new stuff, look at what they're doing about 32-hour work weeks and some of the data around reducing to 4 days. I mean, I'll offer, I've been experimenting with that myself. I stopped taking meetings on Fridays. I stopped allowing anyone to put any meetings on my calendar on Friday. That doesn't mean I don't work sometimes. That doesn't mean that I'm not using that time, for example, for bigger thinking or for something strategic, but it was about trying to redefine the way that the work week looked for me. And I always, in the back of my head is they like, look, if I can bang things out and be productive, hey, I take Friday off, exactly. Right? That is also a key piece to that. But you know, it is not an absolute, but it is a motivation to look, if I'm going to practice what I preach, be on my game, be organized during the 32-hour hours that I've allocated, or, you know, over 4 days, more like 40 generally, you know, but
well, and quite realistically, because I know you, you know, you get in your 40 hours, but there might be an hour in the evening. There might be an hour at 7 o'clock in the morning that, you know,
oh, sure.
Right. So, you know, you've got the 32 scheduled hours, and then what happens?
It's totally right. That. But that also means that there is very little guilt when on a you know Friday afternoon I decide, you know what, I'm firing up the PlayStation.
Exactly. But you planned to take control of it. I would say two things I would point out to people. One is, I want to start a movement in 2021 that we take a lesson from colleges that are all, you know, now remote, and have a 50 or 55 minute hour. Like, don't schedule 60 minute things back to back to back to back to back all day. And the second thing is, I have always put big blocks of time in my schedule that are empty, only because I need to make an attempt to get in the zone, to do writing, to do creative stuff. And I personally need a 3 or 4 hour block of time for that. And sometimes I need that block of time in the middle of the day, usually not late afternoons. It's usually morning when everybody else wants my attention. But if I don't do that, I don't produce. And if you know that's true of you, you need to figure out how to start blocking out that time and have these conversations. And if you're a manager, be open to these conversations.
It's interesting. I just interviewed for Business Tech, and it'll come out in a couple of weeks, actually, a guy who works on software exactly to help people with control of the calendar. So it's interesting how there are technology solutions to do exactly what you just
said. There are things out there. And I will just say, as we're running short on time on this one, there's a concept known as time boxing. And Harvard did a piece on it earlier this year. We've been teaching it in our agile business strategy and business development practice for a number of years. Time boxing is a very productive way to seize back not just control of your time, but the sense of control. Because Dave, you hit it exactly on the head. I didn't just take Friday off. I took it off and I felt totally fine about it. And I was happy. I wasn't freaked out. I wasn't like, I'm missing things. I took the day off and I was fine. And you get that by retaking control of what your commitments are. Technology should be your friend in that area.
Yep.
All right. Next topic.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's move on to our second topic here. One of the things that I find to be the reality teaching us that business opportunities do not move quite so radically quickly as the media announces that they will. We've heard for a number of years, there is no more money in selling hardware. You cannot build a business as a reseller of anything. You must only have services and especially managed services. It's the only viable business model that will survive. And yet, data centers are not going away, even in a cloud world. Now, what I find fascinating about the article that we're linked to here, in a pandemic world where all of the trends have accelerated dramatically, especially migrating things to the cloud, right? That we're doing more cloud than ever. We are doing more off-premises than we forecast for a number of years. And yet what the numbers are showing is people are not going to go exclusively into the cloud. They will maintain a local on-prem resource for edge or for certain applications or for other things. And there will still be a robust and thriving market for selling hardware solutions to your customers. Doesn't mean that the cloud thing didn't come true, because it did times 10 this year. But what it also means is all those things you've heard about the death of the hardware business, please, we still sell a lot of hardware. So, and we will continue to.
I want to push back a little bit, because there's two things here I want to make sure we don't lose in this conversation. Okay. The first is I want to see an overlay of this data against size of customer purchasing. Okay. Right. Because one of the things that I think gets lost in this is, yeah, data centers aren't going away, but they're being built out by very, very large providers, right? Very large providers. Additionally, when they talk about a lot of this quote unquote hybrid cloud, we're really kind of talking about enterprises and upper mid market that have data center investments or that have that have done a significant piece of their own infrastructure. I want to separate that out from the statement of people saying a server on premise in a small law office. There is a difference to that. And the one piece that can get confusing, Ryan, and the way you talked about it is an area we need to be more specific about, is I don't disagree with you on your hardware statement, but hardware is a big word that means a lot of things. Correct. That people could misinterpret, thinking, yeah, that's totally me, because we do not mean you're selling a server into somebody's small office.
Yeah, the idea, I want to make sure people are clear. No one is saying it's still okay to put some Dell server, single point of failure, in somebody's office when for the same amount of money, you can have 10 times the capacity and computing power in the cloud. But part of this is, for those of you who run data centers, I mean, basically Amazon wants you to buy a rack at a time filled from top to bottom with their equipment. That's not cheap. This is not an SMB solution.
And also don't get confused by thinking hardware also means like laptops, desktops, like that's different too. This kind of thinking, because by the way, I didn't think we were going to go completely all cloud everywhere all the time. Like that's never true. But the long tail of this chops off a whole bunch of very small, quote unquote, infrastructure spend in small companies. And I'm going to say sort of sub 250 as an easy line to say, like, you're going to have to really fight me for reasons on why you would ever put physical hardware from a server perspective into those businesses when you can do so much more cloud wise for that spend.
But see, that's the thing, right? That is one of the points that these guys are making, right? So the guy from Gartner, as well as folks from HPE, are both making points very specifically about on-prem server architecture for very specific purposes. And it's right. Not just a question of I will sell you that server. There are modern expectations, right, for energy efficiency and cooling, as well as for uptime, as well as for density and other things around that. But what they're saying is there will always be a use case that can be rationalized for these kinds of applications. And again, I think you're 100% correct. Size matters in the end user of how much they will put into the cloud versus how much they will hold back. But the thing we need to dispel as an industry is if a single point of failure of that blue machine in your closet that's not backed up or connected to any other infrastructure, if that's a problem, well, having one cloud provider where all of your stuff exists and may or may not have access, that's also a single point of failure. It's a diversified piece of architecture internally, but it's still a single point of failure. And the Gartner comment in here that really rung my bell here is that it is not laptops and et cetera, endpoint devices. The future of infrastructure is everywhere. And it is, we are going to continue to sell these things, to service and support them. And they're not just commodity boxes that you drop in and leave them alone. It requires a little bit of brain power in design and configuration and optimization, which, by the way, is actually how you make money selling hardware.
And look, by the way, you know, you heard it first, everybody. Size matters. but actually, and I say that for humor value, but I also say it because I want you to remember that you need to apply these to the right industries and the right perspective on what they're talking about. I love having this conversation about hybrid cloud and such, but what that means is an enterprise data center or a situation where it makes that sense. That's size.
I also want to remind people, our job has always been to be solution providers, which means you put as much processing as you need to have at the point you need to have it. And if it needs to be on site, you put it on site. And if it needs to be in the cloud, you put it in the cloud. Same thing with storage, same thing with memory, same thing with, you know, bandwidth, on and on and on. I mean, a lot of our job used to be moving the choke point so that it was no longer on the networks I controlled, right? Like, right. Move it out to the internet, move it onto the ISP. And that's not really dramatically different today. So there is a right place to have that data set and that processing power. And if it's on site, that's cool. But I think more and more you need to justify that on site. Well,
I mean, look, the ultimate expression of your statement of getting everything out of the choke point is not on my watch. Like, moving it all out to somebody else's problem.
All the choke points are outside my network. That's how we move to the cloud. We just move it all off to somebody else's.
Yeah, it's the ultimate expression of that statement.
But we called it cloud.
Yeah, but see, then again, there is another place to your point, Carl. There are some workloads that need to be right here, right now, inches from the people who are using it because of the aggressive use case scenario. But it's all about the use case. That's what you got to pay attention to.
Right. And don't, you know, base your business plan on exceptions to the rule. So that's one of the next great truths of life. Alrighty. So topic number three, this is one of my favorite topics since day one. And it's kind of an interesting end of an era thing. Uber, and as we record this last week, announced that they're kind of sort of getting out of the automated car driving business, except they're taking their self-driving car department and moving it over to a company they have partial ownership called Aurora in exchange for 20% ownership, and basically let Aurora figure it out. And then if they're successful, you know, Uber will buy it back. I just have to say, my side note on all of this is Uber has never been a good citizen. They've never been profitable. And, you know, lots of other people are having success in this. And I think part of it has to do with the way those other companies run their businesses. And Uber just has never quite figured out what they want to be when they grow up.
That is not a good business. Let's observe. You're exactly right. They have never made any money, right? they do not make money. They're trying to change labor in ways that are not necessarily, you know, helpful and useful, right, from a larger perspective. They are taking advantage of some of those situations in ways to just move money around and subsidizing it with a loss leader. The other thing about this is, you know, that if you go back to their kind of quote unquote their original pitch and say, you know, they wanted to be a technology, a platform for transportation driven by technology. It's like, well, okay, a bunch of that has proven out to not be happening, and either not happening fast enough or not happening in the direction they wanted it to go. And so, you know, yeah, when the grownups have come in and said, you kind of have to make money, guys. Well, now they're having right at some point. Well, here we are. The grownups stepped in and said, you can't have a bro culture. You can't abuse people. You can't abuse workers. Oh, and by the way, you got to make money.
Yeah, because let's be crystal clear about the lesson learned here. This is not a lesson that says that autonomous cars are not a viable business or a pending solution. It is that Uber cannot do that business correctly, and therefore they're shuffling it off to somebody else. Now, a book that I recently read that I found, I had a literal out-of-body experience at just how disconnected from reality the book is, and it was published less than a year ago, right? So the book is called The Future is Faster Than You Think. And they're talking about emerging technologies and the disruptive impact that it will have, not just on business, but on society and all the other industries that are about to be radically disrupted by technology. And then how do you adopt those things? How do you stay fresh? How do you make sure that you stay on the leading edge of businesses that are using technology and not become just chum out the back of the machine, right? I think that part of the book is fascinating. The opening to the book is a story about how our transportation world is about to be completely turned upside down by things like Uber autonomous, Uber sky with the people drones, and Elon's Hyperloop, and other things like that. This book was written in 2018-19. Case studies are very robust. They've got a really compelling story that they're telling. And it couldn't feel more like a really bad 1970s science fiction prediction of what life would be like in the year 2000, right? Like, A, 2020 happened, and B, each of the players that they're referring to that were going to radically transform our world with automated technologies for transportation has screwed the pooch themselves significantly to disrupt their own adoption. That, to me, is the lesson to take away from this thing. I fundamentally buy driverless cars. I fundamentally buy people drones and flying Ubers, right? I fundamentally buy rapid transit and those kinds of technologies, just not by the people that have drop the ball on them. I still think it's going to happen. It's absolutely coming. But read that book and that first chapter, you will be like, did you write this in 1973? And you will realize, no, well, it was less than a year ago.
I have to ask whether or not we should put that book on the reading list or not. It sounds like we shouldn't.
Oh, no, I think this is the thing. Past that first chapter of how do you stay up with emerging technologies? And is there a formulaic way to adopt and build upon disruptive technologies? That part is brilliant analysis. I couldn't endorse it
more. All right. So, yeah. And it's but I'm looking at this, and so I agree with your statement, but I want to say, like, I think the time frame is still longer than people think, because it is a harder problem than we're sometimes willing to take. And I also think that there are other disruptions that actually may be more beneficial sooner. And for example, for me, I'm looking at some of the things. If I think of COVID as the accelerant, right? I think some of the transformation, the way we're talking about transforming cities, suburbs, and reusing spaces is distinctly more optimal. Like, you know, the fact that, you know, having more walkable space, more, you know, people-friendly space. I'll have you, like, within now a mile walk, I am now within a range of scooters. And I was laughing with Sharon the other day going, like, you know what we might actually do? We might walk up and get a scooter and then go zip around. You know,
welcome to the 21st century.
Right. I said, it's a little cold right now, but when it gets a little warmer, I'm totally up for trying it. Like to walk up to the new mixed use community by us and get on a scooter and see if we can go into downtown Fairfax. Cause I think we could. And, you know, I'm looking at it saying like, and I could do that in a simple get out, get some exercise, enjoy some time outside, use the space differently way versus I would have normally said, oh, I'm going to drive my car, you know, the 3 miles to downtown Fairfax.
I have been hot on driverless cars since day one. I mean, I am ready to give up my car. And as this moves along and keeps sort of getting pushed out a little more, you know, you have to say, okay, let's do zero-based thinking. Let's just say that I wanted to get rid of all of our cars and that we would not own cars, but we would, you know, wait for the car to come and pick us up, whether that's an Uber or a Lyft or a driverless car or whatever. Then you start redesigning cities, as you said. What would those cities look like? You might think of like, oh, I don't know, downtown Melbourne, Australia, or many, many, many cities where there's a huge central core that has a usable light rail system, at least in the Western United States. Mass transit has never taken off because when it's 700 miles between me and Ryan, I'm just not hopping on the light rail, right? It is not happening, right? Exactly. But it makes sense in a lot of cities. And I think the first step is let's figure out what else we need to do so that it becomes reasonable to not have a car, right? And some people like having a car and that's totally cool, but to the extent that driverless vehicles are in our future, we do need to start figuring out what the rest of the environment looks like.
See, and I think both of you are onto the tactics, right? And their analysis is in the book and where I've been thinking for a number of years. It's not just transportation. It's everything that's affected by transportation. It's the source and the destination on either end that get reimagined, as you're describing, Dave. It's the way you get from here to there. I believe that the driverless cars are coming. I'm not surprised that the folks at Uber are not going to be the ones who lead that charge.
I know. Shocking.
Yes. Well, alrighty. So, you know what? We should probably think about where this fits in our end of year planning for the Killing It podcast. So just heads up, there might be an end of year show.
We're giving some thought to that because it seems like like everyone needs to do that. Isn't it like the law that you have
it,
to do?
It is the law. Like I've got a whole folder full of end of year prognostications for podcasts. All righty. But now, sadly, we are out of time. Thank you all for joining us. This has been episode 90 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.